CliffCentral.com. Jack Devnarain is sitting opposite me now. I didn't realize you had this very important job as chairman of the South African Guild of Actors. I just immediately thought, oh, this is the famous guy from Isidingo and all the rest of it. And then upon following you on social media, I've discovered that you are chock full of opinions.
Are you saying that you're impressed?
I was never unimpressed with you, but it's nice to actually dig a little deeper with people. And that's one of the reasons I said to my producer the other day, we've got to talk to this guy because, you know, a lot of people think that, and I had this discussion just the other day with somebody, that they can pigeonhole you into one particular thing and that is all you ever are.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's because we're pattern-seeking mammals and we like to simplify the world. But it's very insulting.
Absolutely. I've even been accused a few times of being a celebrity.
Oh, that's the most horrible thing someone can call you.
That is the most limiting, most stifling little box that they can.
Because what does a celebrity do when they're not doing the job of acting or singing or, you know?
I still cannot answer that.
Because what is a celebrity in their spare time?
I don't know. I don't know if they realize who they are if they're not a celebrity. If they're not taking selfies at the time and allowing people to gush over them, I don't think they realize what to do.
Right. So, Jack, listen, first of all, welcome. It's very, very nice to see you.
Thank you.
You couldn't really help it when you were growing up that you had to end up becoming some kind of entertainer because your mom was a drama teacher, right?
Yeah. Yeah, my mom taught me speech and drama at high school. And it was an interesting mix of people. It wasn't just her because I remember my student teacher at the time, and I was in Standard 8, just discovering the world of speech and drama. My student teacher walked in, and he was a complete blast of fresh, ridiculous, mad ideas, who was a Monty Python freak. And this guy just blew me away, and he ended up being Umar Isaac.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
The guy who runs Kahiso now is Prime Media.
Correct, correct.
Umar was your teacher.
Student teacher.
That's unbelievable.
It's madness. And that's
He had that in him. I thought he was in the boardroom most of the time.
He is nuts. That's why I still love him.
Omar Essek was your student teacher.
Yeah, so you can imagine that mix of people and at that time. Also because, Gareth, this was an interesting element in it, is that as much as I loved performance, it wasn't a question about its place in my life. I knew that there was no place in the country for me to make that a professional reality.
No, I mean, this is the sad thing, right? Is that if you're an actor and you just love acting, and I actually had Moonyin Lee in here a while ago, who's you know, done probably in terms of casting and management of talent, probably more than anyone else.
Yeah.
And it's the saddest thing because there are only a certain number of sure things in acting, and even they are very limited. I mean, like getting that role on Isidingo, which is probably where most people will know you from.
Yeah.
And you did a great job on that show, and soapies are huge in South Africa,
yes.
So we have to measure them differently to the way that we would anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
You know, soap opera actors get kind of a B or a C grade rating on American TV, which I think is unfair because they work really hard.
Yeah.
And in this country, the only way you can actually earn a living, not a great living, but you earn a living out of acting is if you're in a soap. Otherwise, you're screwed.
Yeah, then you're fighting amongst the sharks. And truthfully, that is the world of being a freelance performer. So to be on a soapy, especially for as long as I have, you are in the top 5% of the industry. It means that you've taken a slice off the audience attention.
Yeah.
And they know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
They recognize you.
Well, they don't because they'll call you Rajesh Kumar when they meet you, right?
Let me rephrase, Your Honor. They know your character.
But they think you are your character.
Pretty much.
Only happens with soap opera actors. Nobody walks up to Tobey Maguire and goes, "Hey, Spider-Man!" Really believes it's Spider-Man.
Yes, and the thing is, in the format of soapy, you don't have the space or the time of that self-indulgence of going through your process to create this magnificent person.
You don't get to do method acting.
No, there's no time for that.
Because you're on camera.
Yeah.
You're virtually on call every day.
Yes, right? Pretty much.
And then you're sitting around and waiting in between, learning your lines.
Yeah.
Which is hard. You've got to teach me how you learn lines because...
Whiskey.
Is that what you do?
Whiskey.
No, come on, Jack. I mean, this is something... I can't even remember... If you tell me to memorize a paragraph,
yeah,
it'll take me the whole day.
I would probably feel the same. What's important, and this is the difference, is that what is the emotional context of that piece that you're learning? If there's an emotional connection, and I need to say this to this person right now, otherwise they're going to make the mistake of their lives and I can't afford to let them go, then the lines will make sense.
Are you allowed to be a little impromptu?
Yes, yes.
In other words, it's not cast in stone.
Especially on Isidingo, you have some latitude as a professional to say, I know how to make this line better.
Hmm.
So you can assist the process.
But you've kind of earned that right. I mean, some of the new people probably wouldn't want to mess with the script. They'll get into trouble.
It's the other way around.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. most of those younger performers, when they come in, feel as if, well, this is my platform. What the writer has given me is to give me a suggestion of what they think might work, so I'm going to make it my own. Whereas the older, more disciplined actors, especially those who come from the stage background, would say, a lot of care and thought has been given to these words right here. And if you pay attention, you'll hear the rhythm in the line as it's been written. And if you're faithful to that, you'll be telling the story better without you getting yourself in the way of the lines.
In other words, don't get so full of yourself that you start second-guessing the writers.
Stay in your lane.
Wow. I'm fascinated with the acting profession in this country because, as you rightly say, in soap operas, you really are in the top echelon because you have regular employment. Yeah. You become a character that people know and understand and love and get to. They get really under the skin of all these characters, right?
Very much. They invest a lot of themselves in the character.
Absolutely. Why do you think soap operas are such a big deal in South Africa? Do you think it's because people's lives are horrible and they want to have a place where they can escape? Do you think it's because the lives of these characters are more interesting than their own lives? Or do you think it's just kind of tired after a long day, mind-numbing, just watch other people being people?
That is the combination of all the factors. The growth of technology and different media platforms has proven the point you just made, because now when people can afford to download something or to stream content at their leisure, you'll find that they have different viewing habits. But what is taking place in South Africa, and the reasons that soapies are so popular, is because you've got really hardworking people who start their day really early in the morning when they get onto their taxi. They're going to work all day for not a lot of money. They're going to come back late. They're going to have to start supper, feed their family, and in that time, they just want to sit down and watch something. And that's how people have fitted their lives into soapies, so that it's linked in that when I get it, that one chance in my day just to breathe, I'm sitting and watching a soapie.
Do you love it?
I do. I do. I do. I love the discipline. I love the industry. And I love the fact that it's my work as a performer has become a vehicle for so many other things. So I'm passionate about meeting those people. It's something I discovered when I was in the police as well.
Mm-hmm.
I actually love people, dealing with people.
You were in the police. Now tell me about this.
Yeah, this was after, and it goes back to the point I made earlier about there was a time when I couldn't commit to being a professional actor.
Yeah.
What I had was my studies in law.
You were in Durban?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm just a very physical person, and I know I need to be outdoors.
Yeah.
That's just it. And putting all that together, and the fact that I've got a massive student loan sitting above my head like a guillotine, I realized, well, best I get out there and start doing something valuable. And it was 1994. It was the national agenda to create something new, because this was the opportunity that people fought, lived, and died for. And here I am. And I'm thinking, but I have all these tools at my disposal. I can communicate. I can help other people to communicate. We need to get people to serve. Service is a huge thing, even in our discussions right now. And I thought, I can do this. So I joined the police, and I was massively disappointed because of the suspicions that still surrounded the police service.
So you went in with almost a bit of naivety.
I did, absolutely.
And then you discovered very quickly that the police don't even trust the police.
Police don't trust the police. The police is actually business. The facilities and the competencies of the police were being manipulated by criminal syndicates themselves. And you had elements within the police even then. And I remember very well how, because we were so successful at recovering stolen vehicles and sending them to the police pound, we were actually instructed to stop. Because we knew, well, it was discovered that the stolen vehicles from the pound were simply being processed and returned to the networks, to the syndicates that brought them in.
So, I mean, that's pretty disheartening stuff when you're a young man.
Yeah.
And you're all doe-eyed and you look at the world and you think, I'm going to make a difference.
Yes.
Part of the solution and help people. And, I mean, that's the most debilitating thing that can happen to a young guy.
Yeah. And yet I needed that as well, because I realized that there is a social compact between those organs of state that are meant to serve people and assist people. And does that society allow itself to subscribe to those same rules? If society doesn't subscribe, it doesn't matter what you offer. They need to believe in what their government is offering them.
You get the government you deserve.
Pretty much.
What does that say about us now?
We are a self-hating nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we should be ashamed. And it was the seeds of it could be seen then. And I was hugely disappointed then, when my head was still full of ideas of policing, that we lost important, very specialized units. SANAB, child protection, even occult.
Yeah, and there were special investigative units, and then eventually we had the scorpions, then the hawks. The hawks, obviously, useless. But there were these – you could be a specialist policeman.
Yes.
Like you could go in there and you could deal with a particular area of crime, and it would be like in the TV shows.
Yeah, that's right.
Ironically.
Yeah, but that policeman or woman then became an institutional – base of knowledge. So they would be able to track back certain cases that even the police itself couldn't handle, because even in those years you didn't have a digital archiving filing system.
They had the memory.
People. Yes. Institutional memory is something that we had back then, and we had specialized units, and it's gone.
Okay, so let's just talk about this idea of us being a self-hating nation. And you are very vocal on social media, which I think is terrific, because I'm so concerned about people who are apprehensive about saying what they think online because they're going to get some heat for it.
Yeah.
What a way to live.
You can't.
What a way to live, to be afraid the whole time of the backlash if you have an opinion to express.
And even worse, if you don't have an opinion to express. For me, those are the biggest problems. Some of the biggest obstacles to progress in this country are people who haven't taken the time to inform themselves about the circumstances that they live in, and to have an opinion about that. Because we can't just be fighting the people who are pulling us backwards in terms of the economy, creating conditions that are averse to investment. Why should we be fighting that in addition to the people who need to be the heart and soul of the groundswell against the things that are holding us back? We can't be fighting both. As a nation, we need to stand together to instruct our leaders on how they need to deliver on their mandate of service.
Why do you think we hate ourselves? I mean, is this a psychological thing, a group psychology? Is it because we've been so wounded and so badly injured in our past?
Yeah, I wonder about that. And I think it may be too easy to say we are still suffering the trauma of apartheid. I suspect, and this is purely my imaginings, that there is, I'm worried that, you know, people take a moral high ground when they say in 25 years, you know, we are still suffering the effects. And I'm afraid that isn't enough to disguise a latent victim mentality, when we should acknowledge that this is the government of the people. And if it is, then we must acknowledge that you can't be a victim of that government. You can't be both. You are either creating the government of your choice, or you're a victim of a government that is not of your choice.
Right. So what's wrong with this? Like, is it just, are we caught in infantilism? Is it just this desire to be the victim? Is it this desire to get attention for pity and misery? Is that all we have?
It's an excuse for failure and a refusal to admit failure. And every day we face failure, we've got, you know, the president saying, the poor people of this country keep me up at night. And I know he's lying.
Yeah. It's just dishonest from
because
the
there are
up,
more
right?
poor people now than ever before.
Yeah. You're if he really cared about them, he would be doing
yes,
something.
Yes, tell me what you're doing. Tell me what you're doing about it. Don't just give me, you know, the headlines.
But also, we don't inspect things. We don't go into... You've got to ask the hard questions. We don't ask our politicians tough questions because we're content with their rhetoric.
Yeah.
We hear Julius going out and saying things about nationalizing this and nationalizing that and the land and... But these are not real solutions, because if he cared about those things, he'd be out in the rural areas where there are people who live on what chiefs and tribal leaders call their land.
Yeah.
And these people should be given the deeds to that property. But he's not doing that because that's hard work.
Yeah.
It's much easier to stand on a stage and say, the land, and it must be the whitey.
Yeah. And look, this has been the rhetoric for the last 20 years. It might have been the slogan on the T-shirt that would have changed. But the fact that we are still sloganizing like that means that we haven't changed the discourse.
We haven't grown up. We're still stuck in this, daddy's going to come and save you.
Yeah.
Mandela was our daddy.
Yes.
And this, now I'm speaking for white, black, Indian, colored, everybody. We all looked at this situation in 1994, and I was also naive, like you when you went into the police and thought, oh, I'm going to make a contribution. Let's make the world a better place. Let's all kumbaya.
Yeah.
The fact is that for a while we were convinced that we were special.
Yes.
And that special rules would apply to us, and that this government that we had suddenly, that was representative of all the people for a change, would suddenly care for all the people.
Mm.
But actually, it's like a foster home.
Yeah.
Because we were children that didn't have parents, and then suddenly we were adopted into a foster home, and we found out that the foster parents were abusive shits.
Yes.
Who didn't care about us at all. And we ended up being even more wounded. We were wounded enough coming in, and then living under these foster parents, we continued to be molested.
Wasn't it incredible, though, that just the fact that we believed for a while that we were special actually made us behave like we were? We believed it, and that was enough.
It was enough. Where's that gone?
Where's it gone?
Because I hear people, just this morning I had a conversation with someone who said, Mandela sold out, there should have been more violence. And what a thing to say.
Yeah, that
what
horrifies
a thing to
me.
Say, to say there should have been more violence. Yeah. Who would choose more violence?
I can honestly say that every time I track back how we've allowed that kind of narrative to come in, it's because at the very start, when we were exploring what is the meaning of democracy in an everyday understanding of it. What does that mean? We never had democracy pre-94, and now we have it. Okay, so what does it mean to you, Mrs. Khumalo? Right. And what started to come out of that, I realize, is that we started to equate, if we have one man, one vote, if your vote in a constitutional democracy is valued the same as anyone else's, then it should also mean that regardless of what you have earned, regardless of what you have learned and achieved in your lifetime, it's the same as somebody who has achieved nothing. So now you have a Claudie who can walk in as COO of the SABC. He knows nothing about the business. You cannot speak to him about strategic thinking, business strategy, about
income and expenditure.
Yes.
These are not things, these are foreign concepts to him.
And these are fundamental concepts in terms of running an organization of that nature. And yet, in our understanding of democracy and what we've created for ourselves, is this myth that, now hang on, it's democracy. So Claudie has a right to be there along with somebody else who has the qualifications, because actually, this is South Africa.
Everybody's
the
same. But that's not democracy, that's socialism.
Absolutely.
And socialism does not work. I mean, I've had this conversation time and time again with people, and I know from following you on social media, you probably have a similar point of view to me, that how many more people must be killed in the name of this awful ideology before people write it off as wicked a thing as fascism?
I'm looking at the judicial inquiry about Life Isidimeni.
Yes.
Correct.
Thank you. Very good example. So I'm glad you brought that up. Go on.
I shake my head in absolute horror and shame, because I am seeing comments on social media that are vehemently supportive of those same leaders that created the situation in the first place. And I think, are we mad?
Well, on a much less obviously offensive but equally disingenuous platform, I find like the Life Isidimeni thing is so upsetting, because these are the most vulnerable people
absolutely,
in society, right?
Absolutely.
But in the case of Mduduzi Manana, this deputy minister of higher education who pitches up in a fancy suit with a cavalcade of cars and his own protection, like he's some kind of celebrity. You talk about celebrities earlier. Mm. And this guy walks in, effectively, where anyone else would be sent to jail for beating up two women, this guy gets a fine.
Yeah.
So we're not all equal. And it comes from the very people who tried to sell us that nonsense.
Yes.
People who say, we're all equal, everything's the same, it doesn't matter where you come from, your background's not important, blah, blah, blah. Clearly it is.
It is.
If your background is to be ensconced and coddled by the ANC, in the NEC of the ANC particularly, then you have a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah.
And this example is set by the president. It's set from the top and it trickles down.
And I suspect it may have come from even further before that, because I'm looking at why was Thabo Mbeki rejected as that kind of president to connect with grassroots and the people, the working class. He had established himself in the minds of South Africans as an intellectual, and he prided himself on that.
Mm. And he surrounded himself with thinkers, even if they sometimes got it wrong.
Yeah.
Zim, AIDS.
AIDS, yeah.
But he did. He was very much a thinker.
Yes. And it was at that time that people felt, well, this is what it means in the ANC to be a thinker and an intellectual. And people realized, no, but we don't want that.
It's too much work.
It's way too hard. So we're not going to strive for that, because that doesn't feel as if it comes from my place, from where I grew up in the township. I don't relate to that.
I want someone who's like me.
Yeah. Speaks my language.
Thabo Mbeki's too high a grade for the average South African. Is that what – I mean, this is a terrible indictment of the average kind of mover and shaker in the ANC then.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you even have
– and now we have this complete collapse – In terms of any sort of applied thinking in the ANC. You have people like Faith Mutambi and Batabile Dlamini and Mduduzi Manana, for heaven's sake,
who are
the people that we're going to rely on to lead us. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and these are the people who are being celebrated. So within the ANC itself, you've rejected the intellectuals, including the so-called Dr. Paulo Jordan. Mm-hmm. And if we don't trust that, what do we trust? And it seems the trend now, having moved on from the pseudo-intellectuals to the
unintellectuals. Now there's an actual wave of unintellectualism. Like the dumber you can prove yourself to be, the more outrageous, more Claudiesque you are, the more likely you are to be celebrated by people who have done nothing with their lives.
That's the next step in the trend, I predict, Gareth, because now we are looking at the future of the ANC leadership lies in who can be the closest thing to a celebrity.
Well, this is Fikile Mbalula, right?
Pretty much. Razmataz, as long as we are taking selfies at a crime scene, we are making people feel as if they are now being protected by the rule of law, as opposed to actually doing something useful. Tell me, have you upgraded your forensic system? Are there enough rape kits to go around? Are your staff trained to handle domestic violence?
Have we stopped the flow of guns out of police stations?
We have not.
Illegal weapons that are being stolen not by criminals out on the street from other criminals, but from the police.
I remember a particular time where a colleague of mine was shot in the gut attending a hijack scene. And when those suspects were arrested, the gun that the suspect had used, turns out, came from the very police station that she was at.
Oh, my God.
It was sold by the person who was issuing firearms. His name was known to the by the police. He was never suspended. He was never investigated. But in the statement, when that suspect was arrested, he stated in his affidavit where he got the gun from, who he got the gun from, and for how much. Goes back to the point I made earlier. The police is actually business. Mm-hmm. It's big business.
It's so upsetting. So how do you respond to, because you can't really have, you can't have debates and discussions.
No.
Like you and I, if we sat long enough, we'd find a lot of things to disagree about, right?
Yeah.
And that would be a welcome thing, I think.
True.
Because then it would show things that you know about the world that I don't, and things that I might know about the world that you don't, and we would share experiences and come out cleverer.
Yeah.
But the kind of people who we're talking about now are not the sort of people you could sit down and have these conversations with. They've got their eye on the ball, and the ball for them is money.
Yeah.
And the ball for them is celebrity, and it's kind of, we are just objects in their game.
Yeah.
I don't think the president loses sleep over any of us.
I don't think he ever has. He hasn't. If he wasn't conscientious enough to lose sleep over having sex with his buddy's daughter,
yeah,
or to be accused of rape,
mm-hmm,
if your skin is that thick, I don't think you care enough about anything to lose sleep over any of that. I am absolutely convinced. In fact, I sleep better at night knowing that somebody like that doesn't care about me.
Mm.
I'd rather you were indifferent.
But there are lots and lots of people in this country, and you can call them all kinds of names, but these are good people who wish that there was a savior for them. They've been taught Bible stories from the age of like 1, 2, and they started to believe them. And they look to Jacob Zuma, and they see someone who gives them a social grant from his own pocket.
Yes.
And they see someone who's there to save them.
That when he buys...
They're holding out hope.
Yeah, they do. And in fact, they love it when he gets a new Boeing, because for them, it makes them feel better that their leader is a happier man. And I treat people like that with the same suspicion as those who need to have celebrities in their life. Those who need to have Rajesh Kumar, because it makes them feel as if there are heroes out there.
Well, Rajesh is a good character.
He's a good guy.
I mean, he's a good guy. You know, in soapies, you can often be cast as the bad guy, and I somehow think you'd relish to play a much more nasty
I have.
Person.
In fact, I have had some... there is a movie coming out soon enough.
But I'm glad... You know why? I just want to finish this thought. I'm glad that Rajesh isn't a bad guy, because at the moment, I have a lot of Indian friends who say to me that this whole Gupta thing has made them very uncomfortable. Now, you shouldn't ever have to feel that way, because you're an individual.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't feel bad about what all stupid white people around the world do.
Yeah.
You know? But there are a lot of Indian people in South Africa who suddenly feel that because of the sheikhs and the Guptas, there's suddenly this pall across all Indian people, which is so unfair. And,
absolutely.
And that's why I'm glad there are at least characters like Rajesh who are doing things that are upping the racial reputation of what could very easily become, like, you know, in South Africa, we simplify things and we dumb things down.
There was a time when I...
Do you get what I'm going at?
Absolutely. No, and I realize its value, because when I, at the very beginning of my career, I made a point of presenting myself as a South African man and not as a South African Indian man with a mandate to champion the cause of Indian people, because I don't believe I'm qualified. Firstly, I'm not a very good poster.
None of the other Indians put you in charge, right?
Yes.
This is what I always find so interesting, is like on Black Twitter, for example, there are these people with like 80 followers, and they say, we as blacks, and I'm like, who had a meeting and put you and your 80 followers in charge? And those 80 followers probably don't even follow you. They probably added you because they know someone you know.
Absolutely,
Who gave you authority to act on behalf of any group ever? I assume I only speak for myself.
It's all you'll
ever be
able to do.
It's the safest position you can take, right?
Yeah.
The minute you assume to be speaking for everyone, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, and I would never dishonor, you know, my parents, my family, community, and heritage by saying I speak for anyone but me.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, I've made it a point in my career to remind those people, you know what? this idea of celebrity is empty. You don't need, you know, to find that hero. You don't need to go and look for that role model. The thing that you find in that role model is the stuff that you already have in you. You saw it in them, but it's you. And that's my thing. That's what I'm reminding people about. I've done it from the time I started in the character.
Who made you believe that?
I discovered my heroes had feet of clay.
No, no, but what kind of a childhood, what sort of parents did you have that gave you the ability to be confident enough to see things like that reflected back at you? That's a big move.
It is a big move, and it's because I found my heroes had feet of clay.
Who?
My dad.
Yeah?
Yeah. My dad talked a great fight, and when it came down to it, and when we were having our home repossessed, and when I suddenly had to pack my stuff in my bag and, you know, go and sleep in an auntie's room somewhere because we had lost everything, I realized, no, come on now. I needed you to be there. I needed you to fight the fight. I needed you to walk your talk. And when I realized it was just talk, I thought, no, no, I've been doing this wrong. I've been celebrating the wrong people. I was 17.
Hmm.
Yeah. And you know, maybe there is that, the remnants of that trauma in my life still. But it's a lot easier, you'd agree, it's a lot easier to hold yourself to account than to invest your aspirations in someone else in the hope that they'll deliver it for you.
Yeah, but the position you just articulated is a much more difficult position because you are responsible.
Yeah.
And all the work is ahead of you.
Absolutely.
If you are one of those people who throws that responsibility onto someone else and you role model someone else, you make it about them, then when they let you down, you fall very hard.
Mm.
But for the time that you're relying on them, it feels like you're safe.
It does. It also feels like you're disengaged from your own life. And I can't imagine anything worse than being a backseat driver while you're supposed to be handling the car. Take it, own it. And I realized that was my big lesson when for years, I imagined myself to be a full-time professional performer. This is what I would do with my life, Gareth. I'm going to do this and I'm going to meet this person and I want to find out about that. And I'm going to, you know, learn different skills and maybe even travel. And the comfort of all those of those fantasies changed the day I got given the role. And I was invited onto set and we signed the contract and they said, Jack, here's a contract for a year. We want you to do this character. It changed my life. I moved everything up from Durban to Johannesburg, my family and everyone in tow. And it scared the hell out of me. Why? Because I suddenly realized for the first time, I've just been given everything I dreamt of. Now I'm in charge. Now what? Scariest thing in the world. To have your dreams come true.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it hasn't stopped there, though, because this character's become a part of everybody's lives in South Africa, but you've also, I mean, you've been in so many other shows. You've done Ghost in the Darkness, the movie.
Yeah. I was still in the police then.
31 Million Reasons. That was in 2011.
Yeah.
I had to
play a cop, a dirty cop. I loved it.
Yeah, because it must have been easy for you to base that on some of the guys that you might have known.
The dirtiest cops are some of the friendliest guys you ever meet.
I'll bet.
They're there, the family bride.
Yeah, you know, sure.
They'll bring the gifts. They'll entertain the kids. And there's just dirt.
37 Honey Street, Home Affairs, Complex, Snitch. I mean, I could go through this. This is On the Couch, you were Dev.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a comedy series, actually.
Right. This is interesting. Chairman of the South African Guild of Actors.
Mm.
So it's not enough that you have to look after yourself as an actor, but now as the chairman of this South African Guild of Actors, you almost have to be like the big daddy to all the other actors.
Pretty much. And you also have to be prepared to take the hit.
Yeah.
Because
when you speak out about the industry
or
anything like that, right?
That's right. You have to speak out.
So they chose you. They elected you?
I'm an elected member on the executive committee, and because we're a member-based organization and all our members have to pay a membership fee, it forces the actor to decide, what's it worth to you? Because remember, just like you, we are not employed. We are not employees.
You're freelance, so you could get fired and you have one day's notice.
And I remember us chatting about this very briefly on Twitter once about, do you back yourself as a freelancer? Or do you run to the SABC, for example, to say, you know, you need to give me more airtime. You need to play my stuff more. You need to change the quota.
Yeah, entitlement stuff.
You need to protect
me. I'm entitled to more just because I have a talent.
So how about you?
No one's ever paid for that.
Absolutely.
Why should the taxpayer have to foot the bill for some actor who thinks they're not getting enough work?
Absolutely. How good are you as a performer, as a talent? If you're good enough, people will follow you. They'll want to watch your stuff. And if you're not, then you'll
starve. You deserve not to work. Then you must go and get some work that you are more equipped for.
Yes, absolutely. No shame in that.
No.
There is no shame in that. Do the thing that you love. And if you do it well, those rewards will come. Like they say in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, be not attached to the fruits of your labor. And it's something I live with. And it's part of the reason I don't buy into celebritydom. It's for me, what am I doing today? Am I doing it to the best that I can possibly do?
It's another effervescent commodity. Like it's there as soon as you try to grab it, it's gone.
Yeah.
And you can't bank it. Like that I learned very early on too.
Yeah.
When I started in radio and television, you realize very quickly there's nothing you can do to convert celebrity into value.
Yeah.
Into actual currency. It doesn't have a currency.
No, it doesn't. Vanity isn't a commodity.
No. And whether it's you being vain about yourself or other people admiring you, it does no good to anyone.
Yeah.
It builds falsehoods.
That's it. And this is what Saga is so focused on.
No, let's get back to that. Sorry, we you and I are jumping around a lot here. So Saga is the South African Guild of Actors.
Yeah.
It's appropriate, Saga.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember when the organization started, we were concerned about, should it be South African Guild of Artists or South African Guild of Actors? And we couldn't really work it out until we thought, hang on, if we say it wrong, this could be South African Guild of Artists. Okay, no, too terrible to contemplate.
So you're chairman. What does that mean? What is your job?
It means that I must be able to have the bigger picture in terms of what Saga stands for.
Mm-hmm.
In the way we create and sustain relationships, whether it's with government departments or other industry players. And very importantly, we are affiliate members of the global body of actors' unions. So we've got a lot of relationships to manage. And there's another perfect example of something that you can't learn in a textbook. How do you manage relationships? And this is what Saga has to do quite often. And as chairman in particular, I've got to be able to have the bigger picture of where is Saga moving? Are we true to our constitution? And very importantly, you would have seen, you know, in recent years in South Africa, people don't place a lot of stock in governance. But we do, and we have to. Because this is how we earn our credibility. Because there are so many organizations out there, as we said, that pretend to speak on behalf of.
Yeah.
And you challenge them on, I'm sorry, who's your membership? Where are they?
Where do you get this authority from?
Yeah. Now, Saga actually has that.
Yes.
And in order to maintain it, we've got to place that emphasis on governance.
What do you think is the necessary catalyst to help South African actors reach a point where they can, first of all, sustain real careers like you have? How did it happen for you, and where do you think it falls off for so many others?
The catalyst, I think, is going to be a fundamental shift in how we understand freelancers as opposed to employees. The big problem is that in this country, there is far too much power that is vested in the status of being an employee. And that was a necessary step that we've taken over the years since 1994. We had to prevent the exploitation of workers, and we had to try and give them some kind of a platform so that they can voice their fears, their grievances. Mm-hmm. And collective bargaining has become one of the critical factors in what it means to be an employee.
opposed to union representation and all of shop that. Stewards and everything
yes.
else.
Yes, yeah. So it's created the mechanisms. Now you can take a dispute and you can take it to a dispute resolution mechanism and they'll give you a hearing.
Yeah.
You present your case and you'll have somebody there with you all the way through. As a freelancer, you have none of that. None of that. You do not have UIF. There is no such thing as a dispute resolution mechanism. There's no such thing as taking leave, sick leave, family responsibility leave. There's no pension. There's none of that. So how do you manage yourself with so little protection? And we found that in our performance industry, as a direct consequence of the lack of statutory protection, actors are exploited because there's nothing to come back. There's no opportunity for the actor to say, I believe I've been treated unfairly. I am now going to brief an attorney to take this to labor court. No, you don't earn enough. You don't earn enough to go and claim the residuals that the SABC owes you for the last 20 years. So you are left as an actor earning day to day for as long as you continue to be hired. Whatever happens once you're done that day's work, you're not earning anymore.
Do you help people with that at Saga?
We help people understand it.
Okay.
That's part of our mandate. We've got to help actors understand, okay, this is where you are placed. For example, there was the Generation 16.
Yes.
Who adopted the very unfortunate name of Gag 16. They call themselves the Generations Actors Guild. And their dispute was based on a number of untruths.
Okay.
That group of performers genuinely believed that they were employees, even though they had signed the SABC freelance performers agreement. It's a standard agreement. Every single actor on every single SABC soapy and drama series signs the same standard contract. So having missed the headline on that contract and having decided that they are employees, they decided that they need to start claiming the benefits that are due to employees. And that was a mistake. Saga tried to reach out to them to say, guys, you've got the wrong status. Now you need to understand what your status is so that we can continue to fight for what you legitimately believe is yours, but we need to do it in a different way.
Yeah.
And that led to a very unfortunate situation where a lot of people lost their work. A producer who had every right to sue those actors in their personal capacity fortunately decided not to because he was being vilified in the media.
Fundiwundla.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, they were all saying, oh, he's just a greedy bastard. He won't pay these people.
Yeah.
It wasn't him. He wasn't the problem.
No, he wasn't the problem. He wasn't the problem. The actors had a problem with the terms of their contract. That's fantastic. Unfortunately, a lot of them felt that they had an open door with Claudi.
Mm.
And when you think you can play politics at that level, well, go ahead. How far does it get you?
And it didn't work.
As we know.
Shame. And I think it probably did quite a lot of damage to acting.
It did. It did, because unfortunately it presented professional actors who represent the cream of our industry as a bunch of self-serving narcissists.
Do you think we'll ever have a film industry like Nigeria does, like India does?
Wow. I think what you have in Nigeria and India is a lot more of an homogenous nation. You've got,
India's very diverse. I mean, different languages, different religions, different cultural backgrounds. You've got southern and you've got northern and you've got, I mean, there's class differences. It's a very, very broken up place, actually.
I wouldn't say broken up. I would say diverse, but within those subgroups.
Well, yeah, fair enough. Diverse.
Within those subgroups, you have film industry productivity taking place on a vast scale, even within those subgroups.
And the market is so huge, obviously.
Massive.
That helps.
Yeah. And yes, they are thoroughly integrated, which is why I think that even though you're talking about India, North, South, caste.
Tamils and Hindis and you know, every kind of conceivable
difference.
They relate
to each other. They relate to each other in that kind of way that seeks to prize the similarities as opposed to the differences.
Whereas we,
yeah, we draw the divisions and we reinforce them whenever we can. And in that sense, I think those industries are more homogenous than what we find in this country. And again, we have the opportunity to say, all right, well, fine, let's start making movies then about the Indians in Durban. You know, let's tell the story about 1860, or tell the story about the black Jewish people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing enough of that, because...
Also, the problem is that the only people who go and see the Indian Durban movie are Durban Indians. The only people who go and see the Black Jew movie are the Black Jews.
Pretty much.
It makes me sad. It, like, where is our, when did collectivism and the idea of thinking collectively replace agency, individual agency? I would be fascinated to see a movie about either of those two things you just described. Not because I don't... If I'm not involved in this, it's not about me, which is also, again, an effect of social media, that people are so narcissistic at the moment that unless it involves them, and even if it doesn't involve them, they assume it involves
them. Yes, exactly.
Which is why they get upset about things that have nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
And they take offense on other people's behalf, which boggles my mind. But you wouldn't want to learn about another person? You wouldn't want to learn about something so different, so exotic, so completely outside of your normal area of expertise. And this goes across the board. Black people, white people, old people, young people, rich people and poor people. We just live in our little silos.
And we protect it. We defend it. It's almost as if we perceive that we are constantly under attack and that we need to protect our turf all the time.
I blame Blood River.
Yes.
No, I'm... Yes. Listen, this is where this is a seminal moment in history.
Mm.
Because up until that moment, people had mostly got along. There'd been a lot of skirmishes and battles. But people had mostly said, all right, well, that's the Zulus area. We don't go there.
Mm.
This is where the Afrikaans people want to be. We'll go here. Don't go and fight with the Sotho people there. They live on that mountain. You know, there was kind of a very basic, because we were basic creatures 200 years ago. We didn't have science and technology and communication. We probably didn't even understand each other at that stage.
True.
But people had this grudging respect for each other.
And that was a very tenuous one as well.
And then at Blood River, there's this lager thing that happens. And if we, as long as we've got the lager and the women and children are in the middle and the dangerous blacks are coming, it kind of then filtered. And I think it also... It was observed by the Zulu, and it was observed by everyone else, and it's become such a part of our history that now whenever people feel that they need to rally everyone to their cause, they frighten them. They draw that picture of Blood River. They might invert the white for the black, but that's the picture they draw.
I think it's a universal as well. I wonder if you remember...
Well, Trump just did it in America, didn't
exactly,
he?
Yes, exactly the point.
He said to blue-collar white people in middle America... They're coming for your jobs, your culture.
Yeah.
It's all about the minorities.
Yeah.
And they all shut themselves and voted for him.
That for me was it was an extension of what the US had been doing for many years, because I looked back at M. Night Shyamalan's movie The Village.
What a brilliant movie.
I thought, see, now that describes in a wonderful metaphor how when you need to get people to close ranks, you create the idea of the boogeyman.
Yeah, an existential threat.
Yeah. Now you get people scared enough. And if there is no such boogeyman who's making the right sounds to scare these people.
Make him up.
We make him up. So let's make up the boogeyman. And we are doing this to each other all the time. Unfortunately, you have those people who make the right sounds so that it's easy to point fingers at them. So it's easy to point fingers at
white
Julius.
White racists who are carrying old South African flags.
Yes.
Or the president who's stealing from the cop. But actually, it goes deep. It's within our own families.
Absolutely that.
This is the other thing about us, is we're self-absorbed, but we're completely self-unaware.
Yeah.
Like, we talk about rape, and we talk about abuse, and we talk about hatred, and we talk about racism.
Mm.
These things happen in our households.
Yeah.
We know that most rape in this country is domestic. It's between people who know each other.
Yeah.
We know... That in Indian households, there are mothers who, when their daughter's born, they go, oh, she's beautiful, but shame, pity she's so dark, eh?
Yes, absolutely.
That we hear in a certain part of South Africa, there are people who will discriminate against someone from another tribe because they believe they're superior or inferior to those people. We hear about white people who will say, you know, Mavis is part of the family. But Mavis has never, ever had a meal with that family. And she's absolutely not considered.
And we'll say those damn Indian people and this Diwali thing again. The fireworks are terrifying my dogs.
Exactly.
And then a few days later at Guy Fawkes, there it is.
So it's us. It's not just the leaders. We're all rotten to the core with this crap, this fear. And it's this fear of the other, those we do not speak of.
Yes, yes. And we haven't decided yet whether we are willing to judge ourselves, let alone harshly, in order to give us the moral righteousness to hold our own leaders to account.
I think you already said we hate ourselves. I think deep down we know we've got to come to terms with this shit.
Yeah.
And we've got to stop collectivizing each other and ourselves. Because that's the only way we'll free ourselves.
I agree.
Meet someone as a person.
Don't meet them
as a woman or a black person or a white person or an old person or a rich person. Because the minute you put those adjectives, those demographic descriptors in front of someone, you're actually making them an object.
And I think people will have a fair go at it until it becomes convenient to draw those lines again. Because often we need to draw those divisions.
It's the only way we can understand our environment, right? And we love to see threats where they aren't threats because we come from the savannah where we were eaten by things that were stronger than us.
And it's also how we make movies.
It is how we make movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if we're not making a point about, okay, so this person can actually love an Indian, this person can actually respect a black, wow, that's a story.
But now you do a lot of stuff around like, women and self-defense and people looking after themselves and protecting themselves. And you've done a lot of events around Women's Day in particular, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about those. Does this come back from your police days as
well? Yeah, from my police days. And I've had to try and find a way because I'm the first one to say I don't have a qualification in being an instructor. What I know is what I learnt when I was trying to save my own skin in actual combat situations on the street. And these are things that I try to bring into my work as a performer because I look at how actors are required to do the role of Secret Service agent, VIP protection bodyguard, cop, whatever. And I look at the way they're literally just given the holster and the gun and say, right, now we're shooting the scene. You know your lines? Cool, carry on. For me, that's not good enough. Authenticity is everything if you're serious about being a performer. Mm-hmm. Now, in the bigger industries in the US and Europe, UK, they would take this performer and they would train them for weeks just to make sure that they have the skill and it's effortless. But for us, we kind of take that for granted. And I look at the skills that I have and I think, why am I not doing enough to skill the performers, especially SAGA members, in if you are going to do this and you need to be holding a firearm, how can I help you to do it in a kind of way that shows that you got this character? So that maybe you're going to use this character as a showcase when you're putting together your own show reel to show other producers. And I like doing that sort of stuff. I like giving people the certainty of skill that you know you got it. Now you can use it. Are you protecting yourself? Are you protecting your family? And when it comes to it as a performer, are you delivering a convincing performance?
So, I mean, do you have guns?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you believe in the right to have private weapons?
I do, yes. I also believe that whoever is courageous enough to want to be a firearm owner has got to invest a certain number of hours a week to dedicated training. In that.
You've got to go to the range.
You've got to go to the range.
Keep up your weapon and you clean it, you maintain it.
Absolutely. You are dry firing it.
Don't use old ammo.
Absolutely. Absolutely that. If you're not a responsible firearm owner, give it away.
Yeah. Rather don't have it.
Rather not become a victim of your own stupidity.
Now, I didn't know this about you. I mean, there's a lot that I didn't know about you. Motorbikes?
Yeah.
Big part of your life?
Because I had to learn to ride on motor patrol in the police.
Yeah.
So I learned to ride then and I've just been an enthusiast ever since.
Powerlifting?
My sport, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Squat, bench press, deadlift. You get 3 lifts and 3 attempts.
How much you deadlift, bro? No,
buddy,
I know.
No.
you pulled a face now like you just met the worst person in the gym.
Because I hate talking about.
Are you deadlift 1,000 kilograms? What do you got there? Come on.
Okay, I compete at the 82 kilo division,
mm-hmm.
and now at
it's more than I can deadlift by a long way.
I haven't told you how much yet.
Okay.
My body weight is
82. Oh, your body weight's 82. Okay. Yeah. Still, it's more than I can lift. Okay.
And I compete in the Masters 2 category, so I'm 46 years old.
Yeah.
So Masters 2, 82 kilo body weight, and I deadlift 240 kilos.
Yes! Yes. Wow.
Yeah. I need to try and get it up to 250, and then I compete at world level, although I haven't entered into the world champs.
Yeah.
It's usually a cost factor because, you know, it's a small sport in this country. And as long as you win your division at nationals, you are invited to participate at worlds. And my son, who is 19, has been invited ever since he started lifting.
Really? So he caught on to this because you were doing it?
Pretty much. And I never.
You never forced him into it. But yeah. that's fantastic that he could get going so young. When did you start?
I started in my mid-20s. Mm. In fact, I started because my son was born. 19 years ago, I looked at this little beast that I brought into the world and I thought, am I good enough to be your dad? And I thought, well, I have to prove it to myself. I've always been in gym. I love gym, always. But I thought, how do I know? How do I quantify that I'm better today than I was yesterday? And fortunately, there were some really, really helpful lifters in the KZN team where I started lifting. And they just drafted me in and they don't make a big deal of it. It's like, shut up and lift. If you're doing something wrong, they'll tell you or you get injured and you better learn from that.
Wow. You know what? We could sit and talk here for hours, but we've been talking for an hour,
believe it or not. Thank
you. Yeah, I really do want to get you in here again. We talk about your wife. We haven't spoken about her, your kids.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots to talk about. It's a pleasure to actually get to know you a bit better, Jack.
Thank you.
I think our audience will be pleased too.
Thank you. As long as they always remember, the Raj is in charge.
Thank you so much, man.
Thanks, Gareth. CliffCentral.com.